Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Is there a world where, hey, I check into a hospital for XYZ reasons because my arm hurts, and there's an AI that looks at my electronic medical record, my EMR, and says, okay, based on this, you're probably going to have 6 weeks of potential recovery, and you get pinged the second I walk into the hospital.
We fast forward. Firstly, I mean, it's very likely we'll have kind of a user interface at home or even in our pockets, which is either automatically collecting information about different key symptoms and vital signs, or alternatively, we'll just type into it some of the issues we're facing and it will triage us. Either we'll come up with some recommendations of things that we can try out, or it will suggest as the next level up, we should have an appointment with someone. We're starting to see that for many conditions, ranging from mental health to longer term conditions such as cardiovascular disease, digital solutions are available that will just set, based on your current diagnosis, will recommend a daily routine, what you can be eating and drinking, behavior change, and even certain medications that a person can take. And that means that actually the whole healthcare process and experience is potentially managed by that person themselves.
Welcome back to Yang Speaks. I'm Zach Grauman. I'm your co-host. Today we are continuing our series called The Future Of. And today we're talking about the future of healthcare. What we're talking about today, we're hyper-focused on the future of home healthcare workers and how we deliver care to an aging population, which I'm passionate about for a number of reasons. One, it's talking about the future of labor and the future of work, something we ran for president on. One of the reasons we ran was what is happening to our labor force. But it also touches entrepreneurship and tech and thinking outside the box in an older industry. And one of the takeaways we talk about in this episode is that the people creating the products in healthcare tech specifically are not the people who are the end user. So if you're designing Uber or you're creating Peloton or Cameo or any of these newer tech startups, you're a user of the product. But in healthcare, you've got young innovators and young entrepreneurs creating products that are for very either tech averse or older customers. And it's a fascinating dynamic. So today we've got someone who is truly going to impress you. And he's one of those people that makes you ask yourself the question, what am I doing with my life? He's that impressive. So Dr. Ben Meyerthapu, who's the founder of CERA, C-E-R-A, it's a at-home healthcare tech company, but also he's worked in government. He's worked in policy. He's been a resident. He's an actual doctor. He's been a resident physician. He's worked in machine learning. He's got this incredible perspective for someone so young. And this is a topic that I think we all need to focus on and how it hits us, because I'm 33. I'm an elder millennial, if you will. My parents are late 50s, pushing their early 60s. And what happens to them and how they receive care is going to hit my life very hard. And if you're a little older than me, it's going to hit you sooner. Maybe for some of you listening now, it's already hitting you. And the future of healthcare is going to impact us all. We need to talk about it. We need to understand it. We need to prioritize the right initiatives from a government standpoint, from a resources perspective, and the finances and the entrepreneurial innovation. It touches so many different aspects of our lives. So I'm excited. Dr. Ben is, he's the definition of just a world-class innovator and in some ways a real-life superhero. So the future of healthcare with Dr. Ben Meyerthapu here on Yang Speaks right now. Welcome back to the next episode on our limited series, The Future Of. And today we're talking about the future of healthcare. And honestly, there's not, I don't think there's more of a broader topic we could dive into the future of, but I wanted to at least take a certain lane on the future of healthcare and find someone that touched so many different aspects of healthcare, which I'm proud and excited to have Dr. Ben Maruthappu on Yang Speaks today. Dr. Ben, welcome to the show. Welcome to the future of.
Hey, Zach. Great to be here. How's it going?
We're good, you know, living the dream, as they say. I'm glad to be with you. And, you know, I was just saying how you touch so many aspects of healthcare, where both you've started an organization called Sarah. So you're an entrepreneur, you're a doctor, you've worked in policy, you've worked in AI, machine learning, you've done all these, you've worked in government organizations, nonprofits, for-profits, like that's a rare perspective. So some of my best friend, one of my best friends in the world is a pediatric heart surgeon, or there's probably a fancier way for me to say that. But he, one of the things they've told me as a doctor is it's hard because they feel like they can't pick their head up and they're doing great work, but they don't always get to see the big picture because they're literally just helping people on a daily basis. So I'm so curious, tell us a little bit about your background and how you went from, let's call it the med school educational path into now literally cutting edge AI, like startup technology in the entrepreneurial space. Tell us about that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, clearly I have a short attention span based on everything you just said.
No shame in that.
I think, so I first became interested in healthcare, it's kind of, you know, almost a couple of decades ago, where when I was a teenager, I worked in a hospital for a few weeks just to try it out. And I had no intention to work in a hospital long term, but it was something that, you know, my school was organizing placements, you kind of had to do one. And so that's what I did. And I worked in a local hospital, did work experience and focus on cardiology. And actually, I was amazed at how what you learned about in the classroom and the power science could have to transform people's lives. Because even what we would consider now is pretty basic bread and butter medications around blood pressure or around people's cholesterol, they could completely change a person's future. And they may come into hospital in an emergency where they may have had a heart attack, and through the medications they get within hours, their outcome and what's going to happen to them weeks, months, years down the line has been changed on its head. And that's why we've seen in many countries cardiovascular mortality being slashed. And that was my first eye-opening experience into healthcare. And I think the amazing opportunity it provides to kind of change someone's life. And then I went to med school, trained in the UK and the US. When I was in the US, what I thought was phenomenal was how everyone that I came across, it could be a student, could be a nurse, could be a bioscientist, everyone had something innovative that they were working on. Everyone was working on a new startup or a new idea or a new invention to try and change the way healthcare was being delivered. And that's because at that point in time, you know, going back 10 plus years, we were starting to see the digital revolution take hold of many other sectors. You know, Airbnb was picking up pace. More and more people were starting to use Facebook. Uber was starting to expand. All of these household names when it comes to technology in the digital era were popping up. And it was clear that in healthcare, sooner or later, a similar revolution would come about. And when that came about, it would completely change the face of how we deal with medicine, how we look after ourselves, how we think about health, how we think about longevity as well. And then I moved back to the UK, practiced as a doctor, and kind of fell down to earth a bit, where when I was practicing in my early years as a doctor, I would spend my mornings following the attending or the consultant with kind of pen and paper notes and writing up everything they're saying and writing up the management plan as we go from patient to patient to patient. And then in the afternoon, a similar kind of story of, again, writing out many, many forms for that person or the patients we were looking after, requesting different tasks, and again, mainly spending my time on administrative duties. And I kind of thought to myself, I spent all these years studying medicine, spending time in hospital wards, spending time in family care physician practices, and now I'm just really, you know, writing down what a lot of people are saying and kind of doing admin work rather than necessarily trying to focus on directly improving people's lives. And I think that served as a trigger point for trying to look at other ways of improving people's health at scale. And so I kind of branched into policy, where I was fortunate to have a role advising the CEO of the NHS, and NHS is kind of our key health system here in the UK.
So did you just fall into that, or what? Like what did you study in med school, and what did you end up starting out as in terms of your focus?
So my undergrad was in pharmacology.
Okay.
And then I did my clinicals, which was covering all sorts of topics from kind of dermatology to surgery to general medicine through to looking after people in the community through to mental health. I spent some time in the US studying both health policy and using data to analyze how innovations, technologies, and different interventions in healthcare can improve healthcare. And that was on the East Coast in Boston, Massachusetts. Then I came back and I started practicing as a doctor, and it was a bit of a tough slog initially, if I'm honest.
And then you ended up, so how'd you end up in, you said with the NIS?
NHS, so the National Health Service,
yeah.
Is kind of like, it's about 95% of all healthcare services in the UK. It's the main system we have for providing healthcare to people, and it's free at the point of access. And that's kind of an important piece that Brits are proud of. I mean, the NHS actually ranks ahead of kind of the royal family in terms of what it makes people feel proud of being British.
Oh, man, don't. I'm just going to not talk about this today, because you're going to get the rest of us Americans very upset with how many of us go bankrupt because of healthcare costs. So you end up advising there. And usually from an entrepreneurial perspective, at some point you get a bug. When did that itch start with you? Was it further down the road, or what happened there?
It first started when I was on the East Coast and seeing all these people. I mean, everyone could be, again, to a student in their dorm room trying to build kind of a new platform for trying to manage parts of diabetes, all the way to kind of a surgeon coming up with a new medical device for treating people and helping with hip replacements. I mean, that was a massive eye-opener for me, and it was phenomenal. I loved it. And then it made me realize the power that innovation technology had to revolutionize healthcare. But it was only years after that, when I was in policy, that I started getting more entrepreneurial. So I set up something called the NHS Innovation Accelerator, which focuses on getting technologies into the NHS at scale. Because the NHS, ironically, even though some people go on about it being one of the biggest health systems on the planet, it looks after about 1 million patients a day. Ironically, getting scale in the NHS, if you are a new innovative technology, is really tough.
Really?
And that's because of regulation. It's because it's a bit fragmented. It's because of ways of working. It's because some people are kind of almost against using innovation culturally. And so I tried to build a program that explicitly focused on spreading tried and tested technologies, essentially no-brainers that were cheaper and offered better outcomes, across the NHS to benefit patients. And within about 6 months, that benefited 3 or so million people. So it really scaled super fast. And that's because I think there was a huge hunger in the NHS, with especially more forward-thinking clinicians and frontline staff, to adopt innovations. Because in healthcare, you've got this really strange challenge where, on the one hand, we are treating people technically better and better, they're living longer and longer, but on the other hand, the demands for healthcare services are only ever increasing. And because of those increasing demands, healthcare costs are going up, as you've just mentioned. And in almost any country, we're spending, and countries are spending more on healthcare than they are on arguably anything else. And it's increasing at a faster rate than any other sector or industry, which is probably not sustainable.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
In entrepreneurship, in Silicon Valley, there's this mentality, and we had this on the early days of the campaign for Andrew, is like, move fast and break things, right? Don't ask for permission, ask for forgiveness, right? Just go, go, go. And that works in a lot of ways. And we're a society, you're almost forgiving of that, right? Like if you look at Facebook or Google, where they were like darlings in the beginning, and now they're kind of villains because we gave them a little runway and they, you know, you call it, say what you will. But in healthcare, moving fast and breaking things means moving fast and probably killing people, right? Or really, really seriously hurting people's health. Like you can't be that cavalier in healthcare. Like how did that mentality kind of bake into to where you frankly ended up starting your own thing?
You're right. And I think, I mean, for Silicon Valley, I think there are some learnings there because it's tough to move fast and break things. But then actually, if we look back in the history of healthcare, we do see some of the answers. So if we look at how new medical devices or surgical techniques have been rolled out from x-rays to MRI machines. If we look at how new drugs and medications have been rolled out as well, we have a lot of innovation in healthcare that has bubbled up across different countries and different parts of healthcare. And once we evaluate and show that it's relatively safe, it's about having a clear mechanism for rolling that out at scale. Because I think many systems are great at having, if they've got a new blockbuster drug to tackle lung cancer, making that available nationwide. But if we have a revolutionary technology or a digital platform that allows people to receive mental health treatment on their smartphone, and it does, it's been shown to improve outcomes, actually rolling that out is pretty difficult. And we haven't created the networks and the pathways to make that happen fast. And I think that's the balance. We need to be able to evaluate and safely develop new innovations and solutions. But once we've demonstrated they're safe, we want to be able to roll it out super fast so that everyone who can benefit from them does benefit from them.
So is that a policy issue? Is that a business issue? Is that a bureaucracy issue? What solves that?
All of the above.
Great.
So it's not straightforward. I think if we look at healthcare, it's complex. It involves a lot of stakeholders. It's regulated, and all of that tends to slow a lot of innovation down. And even, I mean, if you take how, let's say, Apple innovates the iPhone, the people who are using the iPhone and the people who are building it and the people who are trying to think of new ways to optimize different features are all the same people. Very frequently. And there'll all be people who are buying their own smartphones, and then they're going home in the evening and maybe they're kind of trying out a new app. And that tight alignment between those stakeholders makes it really easy to innovate, to improve, to adopt. I think in healthcare, it's very different. The people who are paying for healthcare are sometimes different from the people who need healthcare, who are different from the people who are administering or prescribing it, who are in turn different from the people coming up with new solutions. Right? You've got patients, you've got professionals and physicians, you've got health insurance companies, hospitals, and then you've got people who are focusing on different forms of R&D, be it research scientists, to data scientists, to developers, to people building startups. And so creating that alignment and the challenges with it, I think, are some of the reasons why healthcare hasn't been able to transform and embrace technology in the way that many, many other sectors already have. And it's been a bit left behind. The challenge that creates is how we also build businesses that align with government policies. Because again, if healthcare is more complex, it takes more time to build successful businesses that are sustainable. And that has an impact on business models. It has an impact on how they're funded, on venture capital. One requires or needs to be more patient. It's very difficult to see the growth that we've seen with ride sharing also occur with healthcare services or digital first healthcare services. And that's why, I mean, we need a combination of governments and policymakers working with entrepreneurs so that we can create long-term sustainable solutions in healthcare. Otherwise, frankly, entrepreneurs and high-quality entrepreneurs are going to be turned off building solutions in health.
You just hit something really, really key I never thought of before. And I imagine most people would think about that, where almost every other business, the people creating it are a form of a customer, or usually the customer. You know, if you're creating an app, you're creating something that you would want to use, right? You're solving a problem in your life. If you're a chef and you're going to cook something great, it's probably because you love food, right? And so there's a certain connectivity between the creation, the process of creating it, the delivery of the creation, and then the actual end product. But if you're trying to, let's say, cure cancer, let's say, and Alzheimer's or ALS or what, go down the list, right? You, by definition, don't have that disease. You don't have that problem, realistically, because if you're sick, you actually can't most likely create that. So there's a disconnect, I imagine, between the creator and the end user that's so void, right? You imagining this army of young people who understand new technologies helping 80 to 90-year-old Americans who grew up in a generation that didn't have that. Am I hitting that right? That's what I think you're saying.
You're exactly right. Exactly. And that's kind of one big challenge in healthcare. I think another one is that, unfortunately, the people who need healthcare the most are usually the ones who are least likely to use technology, right? To your point, someone who's got severe dementia, they're in their late 80s, they've had a hip replacement, it's unlikely they're going to just pop on a Fitbit and start monitoring their health, right? And that presents an additional entrepreneurial challenge, but it also means that if we're not careful, healthcare can actually widen inequalities because it's the healthiest people who are going to use the latest technology rather than addressing those inequalities.
Talk to me about your company, Sarah, because what I love about your company is you tie it to the human side because you're doing a lot of at-home healthcare work, which is some of the most important and less, almost like least talked about form of work. A lot of people think we can have an army of home healthcare workers when it's a really, really hard job. It's physically taxing, it's demanding, it's sometimes infuriating. Tell us about what you've done and like how you've looked at that lens we were just talking about, where like the disconnect in healthcare products and healthcare innovation creation, if you will.
Yeah, so I had the entrepreneurial bug. And I think after my spending my time in the NHS, I realized there was this disconnect between the people who are receiving health technologies and the benefits from them versus the people who really needed it. And I think it hit home the hardest when my mother actually fractured her back and she needed care and support at home. And we as a family, we tried to organize it and it was really difficult because we tried calling different home care companies and I did. And most of them were just too overwhelmed and too busy. They had people they were already looking after. They didn't have carers available. And even when I called them and I said, hey, you're busy, but do you mind dropping me a line back? Sometimes it'd be days before they called me back. And that was a real shame and a challenge, because at a point of crisis, you would go to a care company for peace of mind, but actually they were making the journey more difficult. And it's not because they're not motivated. I think there are a lot of very motivated, very resilient, very good-hearted people in the care sector. It's just that they don't have the tools. And if you walk into a typical home care agency, they're literally using a whiteboard, pen and paper to manage their day-to-day operations. I mean, I've been in home care agencies where they're not even using the internet. And so with those tools or lack of, it becomes really difficult to manage your day-to-day and to organize for caregivers to visit people in their homes, look after them, and then go to other visits. It's like Lyft trying to coordinate its operations without using any form of technology.
Known as smartphones. Yeah. It's like
it's almost impossible, right? And So that was, I mean, that really hit home, and that kind of, for me, was an inspiration for trying to build a digital-first home care company that really was able to push the boundaries on empowering older people to live better lives in their own homes, rather than going to care homes or hospitals or elsewhere, and to use technology to give people the tools they need so that they can provide great care, rather than them being continuously overwhelmed and caught up with administrative work, a bit like when I was a junior doctor and I spent most of my day doing admin and paperwork rather than actually focusing on patient care.
So in your model, you can find, but I'm assuming your mother could sign herself up, but you could probably do it for her as well. Like, exactly. Is that kind of bridging the gap?
Exactly. So we digitize the whole care process, from how someone's onboarded to how carers are recruited to the matching of carers and users based on different characteristics such as time, location, the skills of the carer, the needs of the individual, automating a lot of the back office, which takes the headache out, and also digitalizing the user experience for everyone involved. The carer, the person receiving care, the family member, all of them have an app that they can use to monitor and manage the service. And it also, from a headquarters and operations point of view, it gives us real-time insights into the care that's being provided in someone's home. And that's really important, because in a typical home care company, a carer will visit someone in the home and they will write up using pen and paper notes everything that happened in the visit, because they're required to by the regulator, and then go to the next one. But if something's gone wrong or the carer doesn't know what to do, apart from calling up the agency, which many of the times they're too busy speaking to other carers or trying to sort out another issue that's cropped up, apart from calling them, they have no way of contacting anyone and getting support. And that's an incredibly disempowering experience if you're a carer, to go and visit someone. Let's say they're more drowsy than usual, they haven't been taking their medications, you don't know what to do, and then you've got to go to your next visit. That is a really, I mean, it's a very concerning, it's quite a scary position to be in. But by simply using our app, our carers can communicate with other carers, they can communicate with our team and the family, and it all happens in real time. So what is normally a disempowering experience becomes one where they feel comfortable, they feel safe, they feel supported in delivering a great care. And that's how we've used digital. And we've seen loads of metrics improve as a result, from the quality of the care to the staff experience, to the way we're retaining staff. So that doubles actually after we've rolled our app and given people it, to our ability to identify health issues in the people we're looking after much, much earlier on, because everything's digital, everything's real time. It's all connected, as opposed to using a very traditional system, which sometimes takes weeks to pick up an issue. And it fundamentally allows us to provide a safer, higher quality and more peace of mind service that also is financially more sustainable for the sector as well. We're able to pay caregivers better. We're able to charge less for care. It's a system that hopefully works in the best interest of everyone, because we've been able to use technology.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought, if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15-year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product, and if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and 2 free pillows for our listeners. Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
How are you guys able to, kind of to your earlier point, how are you guys able to find scale? Are you now, you've had this innovation, it works, you've got your metrics, you've got better results on both ends, but both the care worker and the patient, and the cost. Like, this is great. This is your trifecta, if you will. How'd you scale given the bureaucracies and challenges we just talked about?
Yeah, I mean, I think we're fortunate in home care where there is just a massive demand for it. With the aging population.
Doesn't matter. People want it no matter what. They want anything.
they want as any care they can grab onto. I mean, in the UK, as an example, there are about 1 million people today who need care who are not receiving it. That's a massive potential waiting list. And in the US, it would be more like 5 times that figure. It is, you know, millions of people who need care who are currently not getting it. And at the same time, you've got hospitals who may be packed full of patients and are waiting to discharge those patients from hospital into home, but they can't because the care companies aren't ready. They don't have enough caregivers, or they don't have the capacity to deal with it. And that backs up the entire system. You get patients who are stuck in hospital, which means less people can come into the ER or be admitted to hospital in the first place. And so you have waiting lists that queue up the other side, where people may be waiting for treatments or emergency support, but they're not getting it because the hospital is packed out. And that's in turn because care companies are not there when they need them. And so we have been able to grow through partnering with NHS hospitals, and they give us referrals of older people who need to be discharged. And by discharging them rapidly and safely from hospital to home, we're solving a problem for the hospital, we're solving a problem for the patient or the person receiving care. And for us, we're getting a demand for our services. And in that way, we've been able to scale quite rapidly across the UK. So we're now delivering about 25,000 visits a day, making us one of the largest care providers in Europe, actually. So we've grown, I mean, and that's from zero just over 4 years ago.
I'm curious on the training to be a home healthcare worker. Tell me about how they get trained, or they're certified elsewhere, or do you certify them? How do you find your home healthcare workers, and what's the qualifications there?
So we do the outreach, the recruitment, the training, the onboarding, the vetting. We do everything. And that's because the caregivers are the lifeblood of our organization. I mean,
yeah,
we're all about supporting them as much as possible. Exactly. And you want to be able to ensure that we're identifying kind of people who are really motivated by doing a great job and providing great care service, and hopefully have got a good amount of experience under their belt as well. And that means having a very rigorous approach to recruitment. But also, we've digitized most of the recruitment and training process, which allows us, again, to do it much more scalably than a typical care company.
How long is training?
So the training's actually continuous. They have an initial kind of 1 week online and offline training program. And then after that, there's continuous training, which they do online and on a quarterly basis. They'll catch up with us in person to continue their development. And we have a whole career pathway for our carers so that it's not just kind of a one-off, almost transactional relationship, but we are investing in them and allowing them to build a professional career over time. You don't need university. Actually, someone with no experience in care can join and within a short period of time start working on the front line and delivering care services. And for us, you're right. I mean, if we look at the global pandemic, we've seen on the one hand a care crisis and a health crisis, which also has really shone the light on how short we are of caregivers and care staff, especially when they themselves become ill. It puts even more pressure and more difficulty on how we support older people. And on the other hand, we have an economic crisis with unemployment going into several millions, regardless of which country you look at. And we've tried to, at Sera, we try to use technology to actually bring those two crises together and create a solution where people who've lost jobs in airlines, hospitality, retail, we've put them on our training platform, put them on our recruitment platform, and allow them to get jobs in the care sector, both working at Sera, but also even for other care companies, so that they can have a steady income, they can be back at work, and they can make a difference to people's lives, which is really important now more than ever because of the pandemic. And as part of that, we partnered with British Airways, we partnered with Virgin Atlantic, we partnered with a number of different companies so that if they're going through a tough time and having to do restructures and having, unfortunately, to let people go, they're giving those people also an opportunity to have a very fulfilling career in another sector, like the care sector. And that's where we've come in.
How much does a home healthcare worker at Sera make on average or minimum at high end? But how's that work?
So, I mean, in dollars, it's up to about $15, $16 an hour. But if it's kind of depending on the type of care, that it can be more than that. And as they receive more and more training and become more specialized, that hourly rate increases further. And because of our systems and the way we operate, again, people can choose whether they want to work 5 hours a week or 30 hours a week, and we can keep them pretty busy given the demands that we're seeing. And I think to use an analogy, I mean, in the economic crisis in 2008, I think the gig economy was almost born out of that, and lots of roles and opportunities for people to get back to work, be it for ride sharing, food delivery and others, came about. We're seeing that actually coming out of this economic crisis, the care sector is potentially that opportunity where people can get work, hopefully relatively quickly, and an income should they need it.
Right. And it's fulfilling theoretically, right? Or most of the time,
absolutely,
in practice, you're helping people.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Brett Podolsky, co-founder of The Farmer's Dog. We make fresh food for dogs. We started the company when we saw what a huge difference it made in my own dog, Jada, when she stopped eating ultra-processed kibble and started eating fresh, whole food. The Farmer's Dog food isn't fancy. It's just real food delivered to your door in pre-portioned packs. It's better for them and easier for you.
Get 50% off your first box at thefarmersdog.com/podcast. That's thefarmersdog.com/podcast.
I'm so curious, because this is a challenge we had on the campaign, and I've always had it. We have this massive volunteer army that are great, the Yang Gang, we love them. And we would joke, Erica McLeod, who's our kind of organizing, and she or was a humanity forward, and she used to say, I love this analogy, she's like, we have a URL and we have an IRL. We have a URL challenge and an IRL challenge. So we have URL, which is online, and then IRL, which is in real life. And what she meant there was, like, you had people that are really active on Twitter or certain places, but then when it came to, like, getting out there and actually knocking on doors or getting signatures, that was a completely different group of people, generally speaking. And the realities were different, really, that she was getting at. Were there times in the beginning days where the IRL and URL didn't line up and you guys had to flip on the fly or change things up? How did that learning process go for you as you built it?
I mean, we had so many learning experiences. Be a complete roller coaster journey, right? I think even at the beginning, we started more as a marketplace. So if you wanted to organize care for one of your grandparents, you'd hop online, go to our website, and we'd have a list of caregivers in your local area that you could organize yourself to visit your loved one. The challenge there was it didn't actually solve the problem, because most of the time people need care 7 days a week. If they have difficulty getting out of bed on a Tuesday, it's going to be the same on a Saturday. And carers typically work part-time, so you'll need a couple at least. And then if they fall unwell, or let's say they need to take their child to school, they can't make the visit. And you, I mean, maybe you're kind of busy at work, having to deal with that and organize all of the logistics around that. It's challenging. And if it means that, let's say your grandfather that morning isn't going to get their diabetes medications, that's really concerning. And that's probably not the experience that you're looking for. Rather, I think most people we realized quite early on want complete peace of mind. They want someone who's going to take care of everything, including, you know, end to end. We want you to kind of recruit the caregiver, make sure they're completely safe, fully trained, ready to go. And if there are any issues along the way, we want you to take care of it. And if I look back to my own experiences in organizing care, I wanted the same. I wanted peace of mind. I didn't get it. And that was probably the big user need. And so we had to pivot from a marketplace to more of a technology-enabled
or
managed
service.
You had
to soup the nuts, run
exactly.
The whole thing, right? Yeah.
Exactly. And that was a major change. And then, I mean, we've trialed rolling out different product features, and we do this every week and even now, and we're learning that there are some features that really stick and there are others that people just don't want to have. I think we once had a companionship phone line that we introduced so that if an older person wanted to talk to someone, they could call in, or alternatively, we would call them on a regular basis. And They didn't want that because they wanted the in-person support. They wanted someone to come and visit them. They wanted to be able to see them and to talk to them. And that goes back to what you were talking about, how the in-person element is so important. And I think that's something more generally for healthcare. We look at AI, digitalization, genomics, even new devices that's allowing people to kind of monitor and manage their own healthcare. But at the end of the day, there's nothing like someone putting their hand on your shoulder and saying, hey, it's going to be okay.
So, okay. Theoretically, you got a bunch of home healthcare workers and a bunch of sick people who need help. You can create an algorithm, machine learning, to completely optimize the way these massive demand of home healthcare workers and massive demand of patients interact with each other, right? Let's say the human side is I'm sure there are times where you have a sick patient who really wants Dr. Ben to come every time. They really want Sally to come every time, right? And the algorithm maybe didn't work that way initially. Like, how do you balance the like human connection piece? And do people find that disappointing, find that challenging, find it exciting to meet new people? How's that work?
Yeah, Zach. So initially, we didn't focus so much on that. And we realized it was kind of a key user experience change that made a big difference. And so now we solve for continuity. And we always try and ensure that the same individual or group of individuals look after that that individual, the person who's receiving care. And we also tend to have almost kind of mini clusters or teams of caregivers who tend to overlap a lot because that allows them to build relationships. And this is where technology has to drive and support the in-person part and the relational part of care rather than necessarily creating a barrier. And it needs to be invisible and fall into the background, so it's effortless. In the same way that when you use your smartphone, I mean, there's a huge amount of complexity that goes into making it work, but it's because it has a very straightforward user experience, it's something that you can always take it out of the box and start working with it immediately. No one needs to really teach you how it works. And in the same way with care and how we're supporting our carers, we need product features in the user experience that's naturally allows them to use our app. And that's why, again, this is another learning whereby initially we built an app that we thought would be great, but we realized carers didn't like it. And and so really sitting down side by side so that all parts of the app and every feature we're building solves their day-to-day problems and the tiniest problems they're experiencing, that's so important. It's not only important for just improving functionality, it's important for just encouraging adoption so that they don't see it as something they have to use. And I think where technology in healthcare has gone wrong over the past years or even decades is technology has almost been forced on people and it's very clunky, there's no real focus in UX. And as a result, people hate using it. They don't see it as a solution to the difficulties they have on a day-to-day basis and the frictions they go through. They see it as an additional burden. And I mean, giving you a very simple example. So on our app, we have a button that a carer needs to click when they check in to a visit, when they land at the person's home and when they leave. And initially it was just a button. And sometimes they would have pocket check-ins. So they wouldn't be at the person's home and they check in. And that was a real problem for them because they only wanted to check in when they are actually at the person's home. And for regulatory purposes, it's got to be accurate. And so we converted that into a slider where they got a slide 90% of the way to actually check into that person's home. And that small feature made a massive difference to what our carers thought about the app because firstly, they knew we were listening to them and responding to it. But secondly, it went from a product that actually made their day-to-day more difficult to one that made it more easy.
Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started.
For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
Healthcare is so fascinating because there's the logistics where it's like, does it work or not? It's like black or white. And then there's the point of care, the touch. My dad is a biomedical engineer, works a lot with pacemakers, works a lot with doctors, great surgeons. And there's a certain point, particularly in surgery, where it's like, it's almost black and white. Like, did you fix the valve that was broken in the person's heart? Does the pacemaker work or not? Right? Period, the end. But on the other hand, what makes a great doctor is how they interact with their patients, right? Where it's like making them feel okay, calming their nerves. Like a lot of the lack of bedside manner, if you will, can actually cause future health problems if they're stressed the entire time. They need to be calm, working on recovery. And you can go down the list. And if you think about a delivery app, the example I love is like, on one hand, like Amazon, they just need to get the package to the front door. It doesn't particularly matter some ways. But I used to live in New York City and I had two buildings. One was in the front, one was in the back. And I was in the back building. And there would be delivery people who would come and deliver food. And if they had never been there before, they would get lost in the front building. And it was a pain on them. It wasn't fun for me. I had to go find them. I always felt terrible. And there was no familiarity or touch or learned kind of bedside manner, if you will, in the technology to say, hey, in this building, if they're in the R building, wherever it is, it's to go through the courtyard, right? Now, it doesn't particularly matter. It's just food. But when we're talking about people's lives, these touch points, these care points, I mean, they matter, right? And in some ways, they're a difference between life and death. They're a difference between like a massively better quality of life or not. The question I'm getting at is, where does technology go in the healthcare space? And can we get that bedside manner piece right on healthcare and tech?
Yeah, so taking a step back, at the moment, we have a global shortage of healthcare professionals, right? I think at the moment, there's a shortage of around 4.7 million physicians. If you look at somewhere like Africa, it's got 25% of the burden of disease, but it only has 4% of healthcare staff. And so I think the first role that technology can play is simply empowering healthcare professionals to do more and to prioritize better. I think the more we can do to take some of the burdens and the pressures that nurses, physicians, carers, physiotherapists are having on a day-to-day basis, so they are really focusing on the needle movers of the healthcare experience, calming someone down, making them feel better, diagnosing the issues they may have with and the conditions they may have with clarity, and moving swiftly to a very accurate and robust management plan. And that's where technology comes in. And I also think this is where a lot of focus for artificial intelligence has been present over the past years, where I think artificial intelligence has a role in both helping us predict who's going to get certain health conditions before they do, so we can be much more on the front foot. It's got a role in helping us diagnose from decision support to physicians, so that, again, they can be much more focused on the person in front of them and have all the facts that they need at their fingertips, to even the use of AI in diagnostic imaging like x-rays and retinographs. Finally, to using artificial intelligence and machine learning to help us be much more specific about how someone's health is managed.
Is there a world where, hey, I check into a hospital for XYZ reasons because my arm hurts, and there's an AI that looks at my electronic medical record, my EMR, and says, okay, based on this, you're probably going to have 6 weeks of potential recovery, and you get pinged the second I walk into the hospital. And if the diagnosis, you're tracking and the diagnosis hits and you are ready to offer Sarah as soon as I'm ready to leave. Is that what you're talking about, or even more futuristic?
If we fast forward significantly to the future, I mean, the way I see it is, in general, healthcare, like many other sectors, is moving to the home, right? We used to go physically to our bank. We used to go to travel agents. We used to go to shopping malls. Now everything's managed online. It's managed at home. It's managed on our smartphone. And I think in a similar way, if we fast forward, firstly, I mean, it's very likely we'll have kind of a user interface at home or even in our pockets, which is either automatically collecting information about different key symptoms and vital signs. Alternatively, we'll just type into it some of the issues we're facing and it will triage us. Either we'll come up with some recommendations of things that we can try out, or it will suggest as the next level up, we should have an appointment with someone. And that could be, again, telemedicine. So it's in your home, or that person, be it a nurse, doctor, a dietitian, will come and visit you in your home when you need it. So you get that coaching and support. And then after that, even without the human intervention, we're starting to see that for many conditions, ranging from mental health to longer term conditions such as cardiovascular disease, digital solutions are available that will just set, based on your current diagnosis, will recommend a daily routine, what you can be eating and drinking, behavior change, and even certain medications that a person can take. And that means that actually the whole healthcare process and experience is potentially managed by that person themselves. Right? They don't necessarily need to go and see someone. They may even have very limited human interaction. To your example, the diagnosis could just be remotely signed off by a physician who's in a completely different part of the state or a different part of their country and has a number of different recommendations that it needs to sign off. And then you're monitoring and managing your own health condition in your own home, which is a completely different model for healthcare and way more sustainable. And then, of course, there will be some instances where we need to go to a health center for, let's say, a diagnostic test, which could be, you know, having a camera being put in you to see if you're kind of, if your gut's looking as it should do, having an echocardiogram for your heart to check if it's beating appropriately, or having even a surgical intervention. But apart from those very hands-on invasive interventions, everything else can be monitored and managed potentially in your home by yourself.
That is amazing. And would change everything.
Yeah, it completely changes everything. And I think that's what I think digital plus kind of data has to offer to the consumer experience in healthcare. I think the other big game changer is going to be around 3D printing of tissues. So we're starting to see already people are 3D printing bladders, tracheas, so your windpipe. But I think if we fast forward some years, actually, if you've got a challenge with your pancreas, which could be diabetes, you've got a challenge with your heart, or you've got an issue with, let's say, your kidney, rather than taking medications for 5, 10, 20 years, you just get a new organ printed and replaced. And you just keep replacing it just in the same way that if one of the devices that you're using needs kind of a new battery pack or new memory, you're changing it for yourself. That will also turn healthcare on its head because instead of continuously trying to treat and manage conditions, we're curing them by just replacing those organs altogether.
Yeah, you've got a failing heart. We just replace it immediately. We don't have to wait for a donor. I was laughing kind of as you're saying this because how futuristic it sounds of like being able to on-demand healthcare all the time. But just for those of you listening, I used to work with very, very wealthy people in my Wall Street days. Parts of this exists for the uber wealthy. And what you're talking about is with the right technology and management, supply and demand, you can actually democratize this for everybody, which is and it keep getting better and better. You guys can do this in the UK and you've done this really well. And what maybe one of the reasons you have universal healthcare, so the gig economy is something people can benefit from because they don't need a job. They can be flexible with their job because they don't need the benefits. They don't need the healthcare benefits from their employer like we have in the United States. Thoughts on Sarah being able to bring this to the United States? And I also think that's important for other companies as well, because if you're talking about scale, you're talking about supply and demand, making this a global platform could potentially be a game changer too. Thoughts on international expansion for Sarah and other healthcare companies?
Yeah, thanks. So we're actually looking to internationalize this year to another country in Europe. We're looking at a couple of targets, but because we've got so much scale in the UK, I mean, the market is huge, but we also see the global and international opportunity to provide kind of a more digital first, a more sustainable, a higher quality model when it comes to aging well. Most countries are in deep need of this. And so we are looking to internationalize this year. I think the US is in our longer term ambitions because of the way healthcare is it's paid for, and the system itself being quite complex, especially when you look at it on a state-by-state basis, it's something that we're more patient about. But at the same time, I mean, the US is in deep need of a long-term solution to aging and to caring. And I think now, with unemployment as high as it is, and we may see kind of longer term effects of the pandemic and the economic crisis, that obviously provides us with a chance to provide people with new jobs. And that's why we did actually partner with Care.com and another company in the US to launch a similar jobs initiative there that we did compared to the UK, where we supported people who lost roles in hospitality, airlines, retail, and others, so that they could get roles in the front line of care. And that was to create 10,000 jobs. But I think there's a much bigger potential opportunity when it comes to care, and also this future model of healthcare in the home, where people are monitoring, manage their own health conditions with some input from physicians, nurses, and carers, but a limited one. And that really allows us to flip healthcare on its head, to make it much more sustainable, and to make it, frankly, more convenient and high quality compared to what people currently have.
Well, Dr. Ben, I applaud you, because it seemed, I've met a number of, frankly, biotech and health tech entrepreneurs, and you're one of the ones that is really doing this for right reasons. And you guys have proven that, both with the 10,000 jobs work you did for the US, the United States, but also you've done a lot of work on, you know, people in the UK not getting vaccinated because they're not in hospitals, even though they'd meet all the profile and the criteria to be an early, you know, vaccine candidate. My takeaway here is the future of healthcare is going to be like this combination between our humanity and the cool tech, and matching the supply and demand of healthcare and that point of care, bedside manner ability of tech to really customize and deliver healthcare in a very human way. What is exciting you? Like, what, when you look at this 10, 20, 30 years from now, what really gets you excited? And I mean, maybe it's Sarah in itself, but also just in the future of healthcare and technology in this space.
I think, I mean, a lot of things exciting me. I think the genomic revolution is something that we've been talking about for even decades, but only now starting to heat up, which allows us to completely change how we understand people's health and our ability to know whether, I mean, at almost the point of birth, whether what someone's health is going to look like 30, 40 years down the line, and hopefully shift how we're supporting and managing them accordingly. I think the data revolution as well, and we talked about AI, but I think that's so powerful, because we can build algorithms that are able to support individuals in monitoring and managing their own health better. Firstly, that's extremely scalable at a time where healthcare at the moment is not scaling well. Healthcare has a massive backlog of people it needs to look after. Demand's only going through the roof. And it allows us, perhaps for the first time more than ever before, to look at people and support them holistically. Instead of a person seeing a cardiologist and then a gastroenterologist and then their hip surgeon, to actually take into account all of that information together, the health information, their genomic information, how they're doing now, how they're feeling now, and to provide them with the best possible steps forward to monitor and manage their own health, for them to look after themselves, that's going to completely change, not just allowing people to live people longer, but allowing people to live better, which I think thus far we haven't completely cracked. I think most health systems focus on sickness and minimizing sickness rather than maximizing health, and all of these pretty game-changing technologies, as they get put together, will allow us to make that leap.
I'll say this, Dr. Ben, the future can be very bright here, frankly, because of people like you. You have my full support, and hopefully the Yang Gang's full support. You'll find out in the comment section, I guess, of the YouTube page or my Twitter feed, or maybe yours, potentially how this goes. But look, from the bottom of my heart, thank you for joining. Thank you for letting me pick your brain. Thank you for letting me ask you very simple questions and speaking in language that I could understand. I'll have you back on. We'll have you back on in 10 years, and I'll see how right we were. And hopefully we're just, our blinds are so blown and how fast things have changed, and hopefully for the better. So thank you. Thank you. Best of luck with all your work. Go back to saving the world, and we will talk soon.
Awesome. Thanks, Zach. Really appreciate it.